Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Will it take brain science to get our economy moving again? Refis on student loans and why you should worry about a robot named Baxter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, February 18th. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. Happy President's Day, everybody. Here's a question we don't often ask on Marketplace. How do our brains work? That's one of the most basic biological questions about the human race, and it turns out the Obama administration wants to answer it. The White House is working on a multi-billion dollar plan to map human brain activity. Details could be announced as early as next month. Scientists say the decade-long project could spark new medical devices, new therapies, and, okay, here's the marketplace-y part, business opportunities that could fuel economic growth. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
The goal of this project is bold. Understand how the brain works and figure out how to influence or manipulate the mind. Ralph Greenspan is the associate director of the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind at the University of California, San Diego. Greenspan says right now, the brain moves too quickly to assess and measure what happens when we play the piano or recognize a tune.
And we all believe that being able to do that is a key step in understanding how the brain does what it does.
If we can unlock the answers to those questions, Greenspan says he and his colleagues can tackle trickier ones, like what's happening in the brains of people with Alzheimer's or schizophrenia.
That can lead us towards ways to try to bring back balance where things are out of balance.
Greenspan thinks this project will spawn tons of new business for the pharmaceutical industry, of course, and the larger medical field. But the possibilities for high tech may be even greater, says NYU psychology professor Gary Marcus.
I wrote a piece in the New York Times a few years ago about having basically Google built into your brain. That's going to become a reality.
The brain mapping project hasn't been unveiled yet. Scientists, though, believe this initiative could boost the nation's economic growth substantially. But NYU's Marcus says if the U.S. doesn't pour money into the brain, we could lose our intellectual capital.
Scientists need money to do their work, and it's been a tough funding climate here lately.
Marcus says with the EU pursuing a similar project, the country faces a brain drain if it doesn't pony up some cash quick. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wall Street took the day off, but we didn't. Details when we do a different sort of numbers. It doesn't seem fair, right? The U.S. Treasury gets to borrow money at about 2% interest these days. That's the latest yield on the 10-year Treasury note. But when the government turns around and loans that money to college students, most of them end up paying well over 6% interest. Now, there's an idea floating out there to let those student borrowers refinance at lower rates. But why are student loans, on average, more expensive? From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
I started with my go-to guy for all things financial aid, Mark Kantrowitz of FinAid.org. He says there are two big reasons federal student loans cost more than, say, a mortgage or car loan. Nobody checks your credit, and there's no collateral.
If you default on an auto loan, they can repossess your automobile. If you default on a federal education loan, they can't repossess your education.
Kantrowitz says other kinds of unsecured debt, like credit cards, usually cost much more.
For someone with a typical credit pattern of a college graduate, you're talking 10-11% interest rate, maybe even as high as 14%.
Even at comparatively low rates, more people are defaulting on their education loans. And unlike other types of debt, you can't escape student loans by filing for bankruptcy. One youth advocacy group is pitching an idea to make it easier to pay them off, a federal loan refinancing program. Tobin Van Ostern is deputy director of Campus Progress, part of the Liberal Center for American Progress.
If you refinance loans down to 5%, so just the loans that are above that, that would save people about $14 billion in interest rate payments for this year alone.
It would be huge. For us personally, it would just add a significant level of security to us.
Jennifer Belmont Jennings finished law school just as high-paying legal jobs seem to evaporate. She owes about $170,000 in student loans. She says she could really use a few hundred extra dollars a month.
Just from a spending standpoint of being able to do things, you know, we bought a house several years later than we would have had we had that extra money.
And when they did buy a house this year, they got a mortgage rate of 3.7%. It is possible to refinance student loans privately. Mike Cagney is CEO of SoFi. The company makes loans to students and graduates of certain colleges funded by alumni of those schools. For a refi, he says the average borrower comes in with a rate of about 7.2%.
And we're refinancing them into rates between 6 and 6.5. And the borrower savings have been about $10,000 over the life of the loan.
But to qualify, you have to have gone to one of the 79 schools SoFi works with, like Carnegie Mellon or the University of Michigan. To refinance on a large scale, Cagney says the federal government would need to step in. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So if I weren't sitting in the Marketplace host chair today, I admit I might be at the mall checking out the President's Day sales. Honoring past presidents by shopping is now American tradition, let's face it. And merchandisers aren't shy about using Washington or Lincoln to hawk their wares, which got us to wondering about plastering presidential images on everyday merchandise like coffee mugs or keychains. Mitch Stein is a New York attorney who specializes in intellectual property. Mr. Stein, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah.
So explain how this works, Mitch. How do we get Ronald Reagan neckties or Abraham Lincoln tote bags? What are the legalities of this?
The right of publicity, which involves protecting a person's name, likeness, and image, is actually a right granted by state laws. And the relevant state typically is the state in which the celebrity was a citizen at the time of his or her death. So in the case of Ronald Reagan neckties, those rights exist while the person is alive. And under California law, they exist up to 70 years after the death of the celebrity.
I just saw on the web a Ronald Reagan T-shirt. It was actually Ronald Reagan is my homeboy T-shirt. I take it that the family is licensing his image.
Well, that may or may not be true. Certainly, the publicity rights for President Reagan are in effect. He passed away in 2004.
Right.
And so he's got his rights until 2074. But given that presidents are public figures and figures for which commentary and news can be reported. The argument may be for a T-shirt like you mentioned is that this is actually some form of political statement which might be protected against a right of publicity claim.
I've got one word for you, bobblehead. What about bobbleheads? Art or crass commercialism?
That's something that the courts continue to struggle with. We know art on the one hand is protected. You know, probably coffee mugs, on the other hand, are probably not protected.
Yeah.
But where that line falls in the middle is really something that the courts continue to try to sort out.
Do you own anything with a presidential image, Mitch?
Well, my kids received, for this Valentine's Day, a Valentine card from their grandparents, which prominently featured President Obama on the cover.
Ah.
I'm pretty sure the president did not strike a deal with the card company. I'm pretty sure there won't be any injunctions issuing against those cards anytime soon.
Mitch Stein is a partner at the New York law firm Sullivan & Worcester. Mr. Stein, it's been a pleasure.
Sarah, it's been great. Thanks very much.
So you're familiar with fake designer handbags and imitation Apple stores. Well, the state of Idaho is worried about knockoff potatoes. Idaho is trying to block a trademark on its name in Turkey, of all places. Jessica Robinson reports on why a Turkish company wants its own private Idaho.
If you want to get an idea of how serious Idaho is about its potatoes, you don't need to go to a farm. All you need is a busy street. Every standard issue license plate here in Idaho is emblazoned with the words Famous Potatoes. So it's no surprise that alarm bells went off in Idaho last month. That's when the state learned a Turkish company was trying to trademark the Idaho name.
I think it's clear. They want to create a brand and they want to call it Idaho.
Patrick Cole handles legal affairs for the Idaho Potato Commission. He says the trademark would mean if Idaho producers sell their potatoes in Turkey, they wouldn't be allowed to put the word Idaho on them. Cole worries the closely guarded phrase Idaho potatoes could become generic.
You can look at a lot of terms that historically were associated with places, whether it's Brussels sprouts, cheddar, feta. These terms have become generic, so they're not capable of being protected any longer.
Cole points to the struggle of winemakers in Champagne, France, to reclaim the exclusive rights to their name. The Idaho legislature is eager to pick the same fight. State Representative Ken Andrus called the foreign trademark alarming.
To protect that good Idaho label, something needs to be done.
The Idaho legislature unanimously passed a resolution against the Turkish trademark. But on the House floor, Phyllis King, a Democrat from Boise, had a question.
Why do the people in Turkey think that they can use the Idaho label? I mean, why do they want to do that?
Why indeed? Let's ask someone who knows her Turkish.
I'm just very puzzled.
Palin Basca teaches Turkish language and literature at Portland State University.
Idaho itself does not mean anything in Turkish, and I've tried different variations on this. Idaho, it's not even remotely Turkish.
For an answer, I turned to the Turkish agricultural company itself. It's called Beta Ziraat. After unanswered emails to the company and its attorney, I tried calling.
Thank you for calling Beta Agriculture and Trade Company.
I eventually reached a manager who didn't want to be identified on air. He says there's no real attachment to the word Idaho. It's just Turkish farmers like foreign-sounding names. The company plans to use the Idaho label to market its own brand of vegetable seeds. But he says Beta Ziraat has no intention of using the name on potatoes. According to the manager, Turkish patent authorities are already reconsidering the trademark because of the reaction in the U.S. Bob Cumbo is a trademark and copyright lawyer in Seattle. He says even if Idaho wins this round, the global economy is making it tougher for places with unique names to control their brand.
Because the whole idea of having globally enforceable geographical indications is still in discussion and dispute. The standards are going to vary from country to country, and for that reason, it's going to be hit or miss where you can actually enforce these.
So far, the state's Potato Commission has trademarked the name Idaho and phrases like grown in Idaho in 10 countries. But that leaves out a lot of places, including Turkey. In Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, I'm Jessica Robinson for Marketplace.
Coming up, a witty twist on the coffeehouse tip jar.
When you make your tip, you choose by placing your dollar and voting for coffee or sleep, whichever you prefer.
But does it work? First, let's do the numbers. Markets in the U.S. were closed for President's Day, but in Japan, the Nikkei rose 2%. Germany's DAX gained 0.5%. France's CAC 40 added 0.2%. The FTSE stepped down 0.1%. Some other kind of numbers for you today. 5.5 million. That's how many people still subscribe to Reader's Digest. But the magazine's parent company still had to file for bankruptcy. 3% less alcohol. As we reported last week, Maker's Mark announced it would water down its bourbon from 45 to 42% alcohol to keep enough bottles on the shelf. Loyal drinkers were not happy with the move, so the red wax-covered bottles will stay at 90 proof. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Lazy Boy shareholders will see whether they can kick back when the furniture company releases earnings tomorrow. We'll get an idea of demand for new homes when the National Association of Home Builders releases the Housing Market Index for this month. And can you hear me okay? On February 19th, back in 1878, Thomas Edison received a patent for his phonograph. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ristall. The headlines have been full of stories lately about guns in the U.S., the efforts in Washington to tighten firearm regulations after the Newtown tragedy, how gun owners are buying even more in anticipation of stricter gun laws. India has a thriving gun market, too. And as the BBC's Rahul Tandon reports from Calcutta, the demand for guns there is increasing following the brutal murder of a young girl in Delhi.
There are an estimated 40 million guns in India. And as concerns rise about safety here, the number of applications for gun licenses is growing. Tanmay Chatterjee is a spokesperson for the group Indians for Guns.
More and more women are inquiring about the procurement process and are applying for licenses. The rise in the number of applications is very sharp.
But getting a gun license can take years. First, you have to prove there's a direct threat to your life. So the black market for guns is growing, says gun dealer Joydeep Biswas, whose family has been in the gun business for five generations.
Large chunk of section of people is they want it for self-defense. So yes, people are more and more they want that for their own personal safety. They will buy illegal arms irrespective of whether the government gives them license or not.
One estimate puts illegal gun ownership in India at more than 85% of the total. And that, says Biswas, is wiping out businesses like his.
It's coming down. This is a dying trade. It's coming down. We are here because our generations were there. So that's why a lot of these gun shop owners, newer generations are not coming in. So probably maybe we are the last generation in this line of business.
Many of the black market guns are made in India, but they're also coming in from neighbouring Nepal and Bangladesh. And as regulation of gun ownership remains tight and concerns about safety grow, the black market in arms will likely continue to thrive. In Calcutta, I'm the BBC's Rahul Tandon for Marketplace.
What comes to mind when you hear the word robot? A Star Wars movie? That old TV show, The Jetsons? Well, if so, it probably means you haven't worked in a factory lately, because more than 1 million industrial robots work in manufacturing plants all over the world now. And the robots are getting smaller, cheaper, and smarter all the time. Christopher Mims has written an article for the website Quartz titled How Robots Are Eating the Last of America's and the World's Manufacturing Jobs. Christopher, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you spent some time with a robot named Baxter, which was made by Rethink Robotics, who or which you say is so easy to program. You can program this robot drunk and one-handed, which I assume you did.
Yes. So programming Baxter, it's if you have children, it's like your fantasy of how you could teach your toddler to do something, which is that you just grab their hand and then move it over to the task and be like, do this. And then they would just single trial, learn it instantly, and repeat it forever. So Baxter doesn't even – it's not programmed in the conventional sense. You literally grab its wrist and show it what to do.
What's he look like, he? I don't know why I said he, but what does it look like? And how much does it cost? Talk about the economics of this versus human labor.
So Baxter's definitely a he. Baxter has a face and eyes. That's all deliberate.
Yeah.
Rethink Robotics says that Baxter's only going to cost $22,000, which is really cheap for an industrial robot. Typically, they're $100,000 and up. So if the average American worker making minimum wage is making between $15,000 and $16,000 a year, and Baxter costs $22,000, and you can replace that worker entirely with Baxter, then it might make economic sense today. That said, Baxter is still, I would say, somewhat experimental and is in some ways a taste of things to come, although it's an awful lot closer than previous robots have been.
So help me imagine this. The way you're describing the future is a factory full of robots tended to by other robots. The humans in the factory, what are they doing and how many are there?
Well, there might be a handful of humans, and they would be running the machinery that still requires human knowledge and intuition. So if you're making extremely high precision automotive parts, you need somebody who's got a 2-year vocational degree and knows calculus. You also need people to make robots, of course, although not surprisingly, companies that make robots are some of the first to adopt automation as
right.
well.
Where does all this leave the people who used to work in factories who weren't cut out for college? And actually, where does it leave a lot of us? Because what you're describing is a manufacturing environment where there just aren't that many jobs total for human beings. Where's this all leading?
So there are some very smart economists who are working on this problem. And no matter where they are on the political spectrum, when you talk to economists, they say, you know, we need to educate people. Basically, we need people to be smarter than the machines. I think you definitely have a problem of where do low or no-skilled workers go? And that has a lot of economists worried.
Christopher Mims is the technology and science reporter for Quartz. Christopher, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to read his article on robots, just go to our website, marketplace.org. Best quote in the piece, offshoring is just a way station on the road to automation. Check it out. So you walk into a coffee shop, you order your double caramel soy latte or whatever, you pay for it, and then you're faced with a choice. Do you tip? You may have noticed that a lot of shops try to persuade you with those clever or weird messages right on the tip jar. But what really gets us to part with our pocket change? From New York, Jody Avergan of WNYC investigates.
Since you asked, one brilliant tip jar strategy can be found at Rise Coffee in Midtown Manhattan. It's actually two tip jars. Lee Major is the manager.
Every day we change what each jar says. So it's usually a choice between two different things. For example, today the choice was between coffee and sleep. When you make your tip, you choose by placing your dollar and voting for coffee or sleep, whichever you prefer.
As you can imagine, coming up with a choice every day.
The bourbon versus scotch, Knicks versus Nets, duckbill platypus versus the sloth.
Can be pretty tough. And over time, he's learned a little about what it takes to get people to tip. But maybe not what you'd expect.
Although it's a fun game, I don't think that it really affects the amount of total tips. At the end of the day, what increases tips is good service and a great product.
Of course, this is just one coffee shop. It's a pretty small sample size. It's probably worth looking into the larger research on tipping. So I went to tippingresearch.com. That's where you'll find Michael Lin, a professor at the Cornell School of Hotel Management.
I don't know of any studies looking at the effects of tip jar messages on tips. I can speculate.
Which is exactly what we'll do. Professor Lin thinks that Rise Coffee actually may be onto something with their vote-by-tip method.
People find the opportunity to say something about themselves valuable. I would fully expect that that would increase tips.
So I've compiled a list of tip jar messages that I've seen, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to go through some of these and then you tell me what you think.
Sure.
Okay. So there's the classic one that says, Barista College Fund.
I don't think that's terribly clever, funny. I would doubt that that would have a big impact.
Okay. I saw one that said, Every time you don't tip, a child gets a mullet.
Okay. And my guess is that that's an attempt to be funny. It creates positive affect, and people in a good mood tip more. So that might very well work.
If you don't like mullets.
Yeah, it's a joke at the expense of people who have mullets.
I've seen one that just says, don't be a selfish bastard.
People who feel guilt, social pressure, are more likely to leave a tip, but they tend to leave smaller amounts. The biggest thing you can do to increase tips is literally to communicate, hey, everybody else is doing it, and you should too. And frankly, the easiest way to communicate that is not through a message on the jar, but by salting the jar, putting money in yourself.
Okay, baristas, ball's in your court. Meanwhile, back at Rise Coffee, Lee Major is emptying the tip jar and counting the day's results for the showdown between coffee and sleep. Quarters, dollars, even the occasional fiver.
And that's it. Coffee wins by a landslide.
I guess that's a good sign, right? I mean, you are a coffee shop.
I guess so. Although, me personally, I drink a lot of coffee, but a good night's sleep is something very special.
Look, no matter your preference, to Lee and his tip jar, every day is election day. And the important thing is that you vote. In New York, I'm Jody Evergan for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, the longtime owner of the L.A. Lakers died today after battling cancer. Jerry Buss was the man who brought the razzle-dazzle of Hollywood to the NBA. He not only led the Lakers to 10 league championships, but he was one of the most innovative businessmen in sports. Courtside seating, the Laker girls, marquee lineups with stars like Magic, Shaq, and Kobe. Forbes recently listed the Lakers' worth at $1 billion. Buss paid about $67 million for the team back in 1979. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the markets were closed for President's Day. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Julie Padokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Sarah Gardner. Kai's back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.